Today is Wednesday, June 21st. We're going to talk about respiratory anatomy today. Okay, so I'm going to take you to page 67. We're going to talk about respiratory system info there. And what we're going to do today is just take a tour through respiratory anatomy, kind of what you've done in lab, and then we're going to tie into physiology next week. So as we take the tour through, we're going to talk about what each organ in the respiratory system contributes to the process of breathing. You know, not everything in your respiratory passageways is built for gas exchange. In fact, what we want to do is make sure the air that gets to your gas exchange point in the alveoli is ready for it. So when we start here with the nose, the external structures that we see are supported by both cartilage and bone. What bone supports the nose?
Nasal.
Nasal, good. And of course, cartilage there also supports the bone's structure and provides an open airway for air to pass into our nasal cavity. Once inside the nasal cavity, we have these structures called turbinates, and these turbinates are little grooves inside the nasal cavity. What are they good for? What do they contribute? They have mucus, sure. What else?
Don't they warm the air?
They do warm the air, good. What else is in there to help us trap things?
Hair.
Good. Hair and cilia. Good. So the air that travels through these turbines or turbinates is going to be sped up, and that allows for us to sling contaminated debris, bacteria, and viruses against the walls of those turbines. There is a cilia conveyor belt in your nasal cavity, and like any conveyor belt, it's moving items from point A to point B. So what we're doing here is moving cilia toward the back part of your throat so you can swallow it. That mucus that's being moved back toward the back is going to be slid down your throat, down your esophagus, and then it's going to be sent to the stomach where acid is going to destroy the bacteria and viruses. On a cold winter morning, you may have noticed that you have a drippy, runny nose. It may not indicate that you're sick. It just tells us that your conveyor belt is actually slow. So cold weather makes the cilia sweep at a little slower rate. Okay, so some other things we've got in there, we've got smell that comes from olfactory bulbs, and those bulbs, of course, carry information through the cribriform plate back to the brain for interpretation. And we also have a dividing plate here between our nasal cavity and oral cavity. The portion of your palate supported by bone is called what?
Hard
palate, good. What two bones contribute to the hard palate? Palatine, yeah, that's it. So maxillary are your upper jaw bones, and the palatine is the portion at the rear of your hard palate. What is the point of having a palate separate your nasal and oral cavities? You don't want mucus in your mouth, right? And you don't want food in your mucus. So this is a great way to keep those two separated. We also push our tongues up there to chew. We push our tongues to our palates to talk and to swallow. So it's a very good divider between keeping air clean away from the dirty food that's coming in through our nasty mouths, full of bacteria, right? We also have a soft palate back here. No bone for that. It is connective and muscle tissue. And it looks like it doesn't have a really important job, but in fact, it does have an important job. When you swallow, this soft palate suctions up against the nasopharynx. What does that prevent from happening? Something going up, yeah, good. Food going up in that nasal cavity. Likewise, if you cough or, you know, nasty things to talk about here, but if you vomit, that also is going to seal off the opening to your nasopharynx, preventing anything you cough or vomit from coming up from this into the nasopharynx and oral nasal cavity region. I know that you've probably vomited before and had stuff shoot out your nose. It's like the worst thing ever, right? But that's really the goal of that soft palate, is to shut off that passageway back there. You know the little name of that dangling piece, right? Uvula, good. So, in fact, it's meant to be the place where contaminated mucus drips, like a drippy faucet, off the back part of that soft palate. It's supposed to drip and travel on down your esophagus. So notice the physiology here. Notice all the things your nose does. It filters the incoming air. It warms the air. There's a good number of capillaries close to the mucous membrane surface. That's why dry air gives us nosebleeds. This is also a great way for us to humidify the air. Those capillaries not only warm the air, but also bring moisture to the air that we're breathing. And then we did talk about smell as another function of the nose. So really here for the respiratory system, our function is to filter, warm, and humidify that air as it travels further on into the system. We also have some hollow pieces in our bones that are called sinuses. These are also paranasal sinuses, and in this picture we can see two of them. All right, so what is the function of a sinus? Warm and moisten air, yeah. And what do sinuses make?
Mucus.
Good. And of course that mucus drains into your nasal cavity by teeny tiny little tube passageways. And unfortunately, if those passageways get clogged or inflamed, now you can have the mucus back up into your sinuses. If that mucus becomes contaminated and infected with bacteria, what condition do we have?
Sinus
infection, yeah. So we have four sets of them. The sets that are clogged often here around our nose are called the maxillary sinuses. In the frontal bones, we have a pair called the frontal sinuses. What else do we have? Ethmoid and sphenoid. Good. If you have trouble remembering them, keep them in order of films. F-E-M-S stands for frontal, ethmoid, maxillary, and sphenoid. Okay? So those are the four sets of bones that contain a sinus. So if you've ever had a sinus infection back in ethmoid or sphenoid bones, you may not feel stuffed up along the maxillary area, but you may have a headache back behind your eyes. And that's kind of where those two sets of sinuses sit. All right, moving down to the pharynx. What is another name for pharynx?
Throat,
good. From superior to inferior, what are the regions? Good, nasopharyngeal, good. So where should we look to find the nasopharynx region? Yep, behind your nose. So technically it sits above the soft palate. In this picture, you've got a little more activity in this to pay attention to. We do have an opening to the eustachian tube in the nasopharynx region. Where does that auditory or eustachian tube take us?
To the ear.
To the ear, good. And what's the point of having that tube? Drain, yeah. It's to drain fluids, and it's also to open up and equalize pressure. And if you've ridden into the higher elevations, like the mountains, or been on an airplane, if you feel your ears close up, chewing or swallowing or pulling on your earlobes or yawning, opens up that connection to the ear and equalizes pressure. So we know that in kids, that eustachian tube or auditory tube opening lays a little more horizontal. So in little kids, bacteria has an easy time backing up into the middle ear and giving us a condition called otitis media. Fancy language for what?
Ear
infection, right. So as adults, your eustachian tubes are angled down like a slide, and it makes it a little more difficult for bacteria to climb its way up into that middle ear and causing an infection. So they say with age, the chance for ear infections lessens because of the change in the way your head is structured. Let's see, what else do we have back here? We've got a tonsil. It's called the pharyngeal tonsil. The alternate name is what? Adenoids, good, adenoids. So the pharyngeal tonsil is one tonsil. It's just a big mass of a tonsil, and its alternate name is the adenoids. So what does it do for us? Yep, traps bacteria, catches stuff coming in through your nose, and of course there's lymphocytes and macrophages in there that can help destroy that stuff. All right, so you're probably on the top of page 68 with me. So let's drip off the uvula here and end up in the oropharynx region. We're now behind the tongue, and this area is congruent to your mouth. So in this area, we actually have two sets of tonsils. What pair is sitting at the base of your tongue? Lingual, good. And how about the pair sitting on either side of your throat? Palatine, good. So we do have another pair of tonsils here, in fact, two pairs. And finally, we go far enough down that we're now routing air and food into their proper passageways. we have the anterior tube called the larynx and trachea. And what's the posterior tube called?
Esophagus.
Esophagus, good. So at this point, we're going to leave alone the esophagus, and instead we're going to choose to route down the anterior tube into the larynx and trachea. Okay, so really the pharynx has no functions except to have the tonsils trap bacteria. It's a further step in cleansing that air. And then once we get into the larynx, we start further cleaning that air before it heads down into the trachea. So an alternate name for your larynx is voice box. It is an organ, and like all organs, it is composed of two or more what? Tissues, yeah. In fact, there is a hyoid bone at the top. Why is it unusual? It's not attached to anything, right. It is an unusual bone in that it does not articulate with any other bone. It is important for the swallowing process, for moving your tongue. So it is entrapped in a set of muscles, and you can probably feel it sitting up here at the very top of your larynx. We also have a number of cartilages here. We have a type of hyaline cartilage called thyroid cartilage. It is a shield-shaped piece. You probably learned in lab about the laryngeal prominence, which can develop into an Adam's apple in males. Nonetheless, everybody, males and females, have a thyroid piece of cartilage. What is the name of cartilage right below the thyroid cartilage? Cricoid, good. And if you continue further down, we've now left the larynx, and what is this piece of the tube known as?
Trachea.
Trachea, good. Once we open up and look inside the larynx, you'll notice there is a flap here, and that flap is sticking up. That's known as what? Good. Do you recall the type of tissue that makes up the epiglottis? E for E. Elastic, yeah. Elastic cartilage makes up the epiglottis. Good. So how would you describe elastic cartilage? Stretchy, right. So it's a very flexible, stretchy type of tissue. So the goal here is to help shut off the opening to the larynx when you swallow. It's kind of like a trash can lid. It slams over the opening to your larynx, lets you swallow food down your esophagus. When you're done swallowing, it slides back into position and remains open as long as you're breathing. If you put your hand on your trachea and feel for your larynx, take a moment to swallow. You'll feel your entire larynx move up as it caps over your glottis opening, and then it will slide back down when you're done swallowing. So a pretty cool mechanism in there. We also have a set of vocal cords that are inside the larynx. Their job is to make a buzzing, humming noise. We actually learn to manipulate our tongues and our lips to make sounds, but by themselves, the larynx is just going to make a humming or a buzzing noise. So speech involves more than just your vocal cords. Nonetheless, they are folds of mucous membrane. They are to vibrate and help us produce speech. Okay, so there is a shot of the glottis. How is the glottis different from the epiglottis?
Just the opening.
Just the opening, good. So that opening there is the glottis. Some textbooks say the glottis also includes the surrounding vocal cords, but if you want to be specific, the opening inside is the glottis, the vocal cords are on either side, but together they work as a unit to control the air passageways down into your lungs. I do want to bring you back full circle. In our last chapter, we talked about the Valsalva's maneuver, and that involves the closure of your vocal cords. So they kind of act like elevator doors. When you hold your breath, those vocal cords slam shut, then air is trapped in your lungs. You might think of this as a way to increase intra-abdominal pressure by forcing air to stay in your lungs. So if you bend over to pick up something off the floor, if you're pushing to have a bowel movement, anything that needs to increase pressure in your abdomen, we automatically engage this Valsalva's maneuver. All right, so the catch is when you do the Valsalva's maneuver, you also trigger the vagus nerve. So what impact does the vagus nerve have on heart rate?
Slows it
down. Good. What neurotransmitter is now released?
Acetylcholine.
Good. Does the vagus nerve do anything with your blood vessels?
No,
because there's no innervation there. So technically, the rate is slowed by the vagus nerve and the increased acetylcholine present. So kind of an interesting thing that if you hold your breath, that you can actually engage and stimulate that vagus nerve. Let's see, I wanted to show you this video real quick. There is an answer key. Brooke, do you still have the answer key?
No, I got it from
somebody else. Okay. You done with the answer key? Clooney sells tequila brand, yeah, for $1 billion. You see that down there? Okay, so there is sound. It's hard to hear. I don't have a speaker in here.
Laugh or scream. But take a look down the talented gullet of Steven Tyler, Aerosmith's lead singer. And you get a feel for why he and millions of others are wreaking havoc on a delicate instrument.
Okay.
Tonight, as Aerosmith performs, Dr. Steven Zeitels and his team from Massachusetts General Hospital will get a rare treat. With the help of special monitoring equipment, they'll see how this famous pair of vocal cords holds up to such extremes.
Dr. Zeitels, one time for my kids, what is this monitoring?
What we're going to be doing is looking at the vibrations on the skin of your neck, which is going to pick up the intensity of your voice. Mm-hmm. It's going to be picking up the loudness of your voice.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, doctor.
Okay. Into the abyss.
Oh. Into the great beyond.
There we go.
Dr. Zeitels.
Backstage, throughout tonight's concert, Zeitels will use an endoscope to examine Tyler's voice box up close.
See, can I have the gauze?
Try not to touch the sides.
Yep. Just turn that for me. Just breathe, say It's a rare insight into what goes on in a high-performance singer.
Real-time measures of a performer who is at the top of his game, doing a live performance in front of thousands of people. That's the first.
That's
the done.
Of sounds, Tyler's vocal cords are slamming together an average of 170 times a second.
In case you didn't hear that,
that's more than half a million times during the course of a concert, and nearly a billion times during the course of his 30-year professional career.
There's no part of the human body that likely sees these kinds of collision forces and shearing stresses, which is why vocal folds essentially wear out over time.
It's also why just months earlier, damaged vocal cords canceled much of Aerosmith's tour. Tyler could barely sing.
Okay, so I thought you'd enjoy getting to see vocal cords in action, because that's pretty cool to see how they move. Okay, so that should take us down there to the bottom of page 68. Do y'all have any questions so far on that page? What y'all got back there? Oh. He can stay back there. I'd help you, but you know. Yeah. You're absolutely welcome to move if you need to. Okay, so epiglottis is, of course, the flap here in this picture. There's your vocal cords, and the opening inside is the glottis there inside those vocal cords. You may recall Joan Rivers passed away about a couple of years ago, and she had gone through she was actually going through kind of what Steven Tyler was having done. They were investigating her vocal cords, and they had put her to sleep with, let me say it right, propofenol, the drug that Michael Jackson had been using, and it apparently caused her vocal cords to lock shut. And unfortunately, when you lock them shut, there's no air coming and going out of the lungs. And she died because of that. And if you followed the story, her family sued. They said it was something that could have been helped or prevented. What could they have done for her had they realized her vocal cords had locked shut?
Intubator,
or they could have, in an emergency, done a tracheotomy. Yeah, because that would have helped bypass this locked up set of vocal cords. So, you know, sadly for the family, it appears to have been a completely preventable problem had they had an anesthesiologist on site, which they did not, and had they done something about the vocal cords once they locked shut. Because once they locked shut, that's it for breathing. So the goal of passing through the glottis is to get to the trachea. That's our next stop on our tour. So we're going to head on over to the top of page 69. Give you something, yeah. So the trachea is about a 4-inch long windpipe. It stands open, and because of that, we say it is a patent airway. It does not have anything to support its structure except for C rings of cartilage, which are keeping it open. Otherwise, you would have to work too hard to help move air into an airway that was actually collapsed or closed. Notice in this picture that the C rings of cartilage only travel in the front and sides of the trachea. Those rings do not travel to the backside. Why not? What's back here? Your esophagus, right? And what travels down the esophagus? Right, and if you had, I heard one of you say it, spine is back here. So if food travels down your esophagus, you can't push against your spine. That means the only way you can push is into this neighborhood of your trachea. I know we probably all swallowed a piece of food that you could feel go all the way down your esophagus. And so it may, in fact, be pushing against this piece where there's no C rings. You can also have esophageal spasms that you can feel as the food is traveling down toward the stomach. So this is hyaline cartilage. It is meant to keep the airway open for air to travel down. The lining inside here is actually pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelial tissue. God, imagine if that was your name, right? So this time the cilia has a conveyor belt that's pushing up towards your mouth. Why push the contaminated mucus up towards your mouth? Get it out, right? So swallow it, cough it, do something with it where it does not get further into your lung tissue. The goal is to keep it away from those alveoli where the gas exchange and the blood vessels are located. Okay, so I wanted to show you this picture because there are a set of muscles that are in the walls of those trachea. And these muscles, the trachealis muscle, will actually help control the diameter of your trachea. So on your worksheet, you'll notice there, under physiology, that during sympathetic stimulation, what happens to the diameter of your trachea?
Dilates.
What are we trying to get more of?
Air.
More air, yeah. So this is opposite of blood vessels, right? Blood vessels constrict under sympathetic stimulation. But here, the trachea actually relaxes and dilates to get more air coming in. Under parasympathetic control, your trachea constricts, so it relaxes back down to a more tightened state. It returns to a normal state where we actually don't have to demand so much oxygen coming in. So again, we're looking at kind of a different setup than what we saw with those blood vessels. All right, and then in this picture, I did want to point out the carina or carina, however you'd like to say it. Where is it located? It's a V, yes. So that little V-shaped structure is the last piece of cartilage in your trachea. It is the division point between the left and the right primary bronchus. The reason we point this one out, it is a great place for pneumococcus bacteria to hang out and cause, guess what?
Pneumonia.
Yep, so that is a likely place for bacteria to collect. All right, so heading down into the bronchi, I want to emphasize that the word bronchus is a single tube. Bronchi is a plural for those multiple tubes. What is the difference between the right and left primary bronchus? Take a close. Which one's wider?
The right
one's wider, good. Why do you think there's a difference in the structure between the right and the left primary bronchus? More lobes on the right side. And what organ is sitting in the mediastinum? Heart, yeah. So that's going to make a little difference here between the right and the left primary bronchi. And you're right, there's more lobes to serve on that right side lung than the left side. I point this out because if you aspirate or suck food into this area, the right primary bronchus is more likely the place for items to be aspirated and stuck. Why do you think that's the case? Yeah, it's got more space there, right? It's wider. So they say that hot dogs are a perfect fit for the right primary bronchus, as are peppermint candies. So if you happen to suck one of those down, it puts a plug right in that right primary bronchus. Every few years, a parents' advocacy group always goes out and says, hey, let's remodel hot dogs. Let's not make them into rings. Let's make them into some other structure, because there's kids that die every year from having aspirated hot dogs cut into slices or rings that are sucked down into that right primary bronchus. So how do you get stuff out that's stuck in that right primary bronchus? Heimlich maneuver, right. So how does that work? Push up under the diaphragm, use the air in your lungs, and force those things out. So, you know, that's the best way to get something to dislodge from that right primary bronchus. So the left one is more narrow, it is longer, and again, it's all about the heart making an asymmetrical shape of these two bronchi here. So what do the primary bronchi branch into? Secondary, good. And they branch into?
Tertiary.
So we just follow the branch to a second branch, then to a third branch, and then the last set of branches are going to be bronchioles. So they serve these alveoli inside the lung tissue. I did want to mention one more time that we're still dealing with pseudostratified, ciliated, columnar epithelial tissue, and those cilia have a conveyor belt that works contaminated mucus up to the mouth. So all of this stuff from the larynx down is pushing contaminated mucus up. All right, so that takes us to the very bottom of your page with the bronchioles. So far we have a pathway here starting with the trachea, primary, secondary, tertiary bronchi. We're not going to fiddle with these various types of bronchioles. We're just going to be generic and say bronchioles are next. And you'll notice that they serve these alveolar sacs that happen to be the site for gas exchange. So what happens to the diameter when you travel from trachea to bronchi to bronchioles? Smaller, good. In fact, bronchioles are so tiny that they will lose their rings of cartilage that keep them open. Those rings of cartilage were common in the primary, secondary, and tertiary bronchi. Also, the bronchioles become so thin-walled that they are now the site of gas exchange along with those alveoli. So at the bottom of your page, you'll notice that some of your bronchioles are part of a respiratory tree. Okay, and the respiratory tree is actually getting into the thinnest branches where we can now have exchanges of gas take place. Okay, so these are now the place where we're starting to perform gas exchange. Because these bronchioles are so small, they don't have room for cilia inside. Neither do the alveoli. They too are too small for cilia to sweep out contaminated mucus. So how do we get rid of any kind of bacteria or viruses that have made it this far? Macrophages. Good. What do macrophages do? Eat. Good. So they eat up the bacteria or viruses that have made it this far. How about questions so far? Why don't I make a note that we're going to start on the top of page 70 on Monday. Y'all have a good weekend.